That's it. No, I think it's coming out. Yes, it is. So the first letter was from Eleanor Rathbone to you on the 23rd of December 1944. And she says, "Dear VC, first, you are a wicked woman to send me with Helga, comma, a Christmas box. All the same, it's a charming little plant and will make our table look very gay, and so I accept it gratefully, if disapprovingly." New paragraph. "The rest of this letter is a business matter, comma, but as I want it to reach you before Xmas, comma, I mix it up, stop. I enclose my promised cheque from my private H holiday, F fund, stop. Of course, it can serve for one good or several tiny holidays, comma, and..." "And now, or sometime hence, comma, just as you wish, stop." New paragraph. "But I was greatly perturbed when you confessed that you had made no provision whatever for old age or serious contingencies such as illness, comma, brackets, except, of course, comma, through compulsory insurance, comma. It won't be a very generous provision, even under the new scheme, stop, brackets, exclamation mark. I'm afraid your inadequate salary is partly responsible, stop, so I want to make you a little parting present of £50, comma, as the nucleus of such a provision, comma, which I do hope, dash, now that you are getting a rather better salary, comma, you will, underlined, regularly add to, all underlined, probably," new paragraph, "probably the best form will be war loan, best fund, perhaps, will be war loan, capital W, capital L, stop, but as you don't seem exactly to excel as a businesswoman, comma, I think of writing to the chief partner in our family business first, comma, to consult him as to the best method of saving, dash, whether through war loan, capital W, capital L, or some kind of insurance or defence annuity on a life basis, etc. Dash, I'll let you know the result, and then it will be for you to say whether you like to follow his suggestion, brackets, I'm not giving him your name, etc., unbrackets, or to do something else, stop. Only do make it the start of, and this is underlined, a regular system of saving, end of underlining, dash. I know you won't mind the suggestion. I'm not the scion of a long line of thrifty business people for nothing, exclamation mark. Yours ever, and with my gratitude for all your work for that rather ungrateful and tiresome, capital P, parliamentary, capital C, committee." And then she writes on the 16th of March, 1945, "Dear VC, you must have thought I'd quite forgotten about the long hyphen promised cheque. Not at all, semicolon, merely the usual reason that whenever I took, quote, took up my pen, unquote, comma, something more urgent claimed it. New paragraph. I've made it £75, comma, so as to make up with the £25 for holidays, I did send that, comma, didn't I, unbrackets, a total of £100 as some recognition of your underpaid and devoted work for the Parliamentary Committee, capital P, capital C. I think I told you that my advisor recommends capital W, war savings certificates, capital S, capital C, as the most convenient and profitable way of saving. Could be prop. I think it must be a profitable way of saving. Stop. But of course, do as you like about that. Yours ever, Eleanor Rathbone. Did you actually put in... I mean, you weren't one of these people who had 9 to 5 hours, were you, at all? I mean, you...
You were devoted to the cause. Day and night, whatever, yes, exactly, yes.
I really wondered, you see, why she sent this. I mean, had she got some hint from somebody else that you were not well off?
She had asked me, and I was very poorly paid. I've got some correspondence, or not correspondence, but documentation about parliamentary committee things. Eleanor, the way she set the parliamentary committee up was already typical. She saw the need for an organisation. She funded it. She found staff for it. And being, as she says, a thrifty businesswoman, paid as little as possible. I was far more interested in the job than the money, and because that's really the way I made, you know. And I received, I think it was about 200 a year or something. And well, even in those days, you know, that was pretty poor pay, but it was sort of just enough. And I lived most of the time. One room in my flat was the office for which she paid rent, and one was my room for which I paid rent, you see. And all the expenses of running an office were found by Eleanor. The sort of kudos accruing to the parliamentary committee was shared by every member of the parliamentary committee, people like Cazalet and Lord Marley and Graham White, who was later the chairman. And when Eleanor was... she was ill. I think, I don't know whether she'd had a little accident or whether she was ill almost for the first time in her life. Somewhere about 1942, maybe. I took up the matter of the fact that it was a burden solely on Eleanor, and the fact that I was being very poorly paid. And I know that Graham White, in his report to the Parliamentary Committee in her absence, mentioned the fact that he could say it because she was away, that she was carrying the entire burden,
financial burden of
the office for the rest of them.
But this flat you had, was it your flat?
Yes. Well, first of all, we used the offices 35 Marsham Street of the Family Endowment Society, and merely sort of shelved Family Endowment pro tem and got busy with the Parliamentary Committee. Then we were bombed, and so I had to find a place for myself. And I found 7 Cowley Street, which I have an idea is now the SDP headquarters.
Really?
Yes, I think so. And I had somebody, Brody Bonham Carter, solicitors,
right.
And I had the top floor, and they had also been bombed, so nobody wanted the top floor except me. It didn't rang very much, you know, and it was a... long haul up the stairs, but a lovely little flat. And one room was parliamentary committee, and as I say, Eleanor paid the half the rent.
I see. You see. And you lived in the
and
other
I lived
half.
In the other. In
really?
The
what,
other
what, sort of bathroom, kitchen, everything?
And one room, and then a kitchen plus bathroom and loo, and that was it. And the other room was the office.
Of course, in those days, you just were thankful to have a home at all, I imagine, in London. I mean, weren't fussy, really, particularly as a young woman, I suppose.
Well, my husband was teaching and living out at Woodford and had his flat out there. So, you know, I lived with the job. And it was morning, noon and night because, you know, refugees would ring up in the middle of the night and say, "Oh, Miss Craig, I am so terrible down with my nerves," you know, and things like this. And
so you never had any fixed hours? No.
And I remember once saying to Eleanor that I wanted to go away for a weekend, and you know, so would it be all right with her if I was not in the office on Saturday? And she said, she sort of demurred and said, "Well, you know, you often get a lot of inquiries on Saturday, and I believe there is a lot of work in the office." And I said, "But hang it all, you know, I haven't had a weekend off for months and months, and my husband is getting a bit fed up that he always has to come to London to see me instead of my going out to see him. And I would like to go out on Friday and stay till Monday morning." And her peculiar reply was, "Well, of course, your husband," and I said, "Yes, you know I have a husband." And she said, "Well, why do you call yourself Miss Craig?" So I said, "Well, that was my name as a journalist." And she said, "Well, I don't approve of promiscuity."
What, did she say that seriously?
Dead seriously.
That's ridiculous.
And I think probably she was, at the back of her mind, she'd had sort of various hints that some of my refugee friends were seeing me not sort of all the time strictly on business.
What I don't understand about that, though, did she not know you were married?
Yes, of course she did, but she'd, well, if you'd like, she'd sort of forgotten
more.
You know, she wanted to get the bit in about...
Yes, I see,
not,
yes.
After Doris left her.
Yes.
I can't remember the good girl's name. She was a very nice person. And she thought that Eleanor was an absolutely inhuman person.
I think you did mention that.
Yes.
Yes.
I remember. Yes.
You've got to be dedicated, really, haven't you, really, to get on or understand Eleanor at all, really.
Yes, I think so. And really, if your sort of own petty private life is of so much importance to you, I think, you know, this girl had come in and said that she had a migraine or, you know, was feeling rotten or something, and Eleanor said, "Well, you know, now get on with your work, more or less." And, I mean, as Eleanor would, I mean, if you're busy, you can't
just
fight
through. Sort of thing.
Yes.
Also, of course, she was reading these awful reports of concentration camps and so on. All
exactly,
the time.
Exactly.
So he gets it all in rather a sort of different perspective.
And I remember also an occasion when I told her about a very, very dear couple who had taken their lives at the time of general internment because the police were coming round and knocking on doors at 3 o'clock in the morning and taking the man away. And they had gone out to Wandsworth Common or somewhere and drunk a bottle of poison between them. And I was shattered because they were an absolutely delightful old couple, middle-aged couple, and they'd already gone through hell in their own country. And I told Eleanor about this, and her reply was, "If people are so feeble that that's their response to a situation, It's better if they don't live in this world."
Rather surprisingly understanding that, really, isn't it? Because, I mean, you imagine, as a visitor to Britain, that, oh, it's all happening again, sort of thing, don't you? I mean,
yes.
People are knocking on doors.
Exactly. Now, you see, she would see the general situation as an appalling and disgraceful thing. But when it actually came down to a couple, if you like, responding in this way, then she saw them as, you know, two feeble individuals.
Yes, so she's got a generalised compassion, but
yes,
not...
Yes, that's it,
not,
that's it, that's it, that's
yes.
it, exactly.
Mm.
A supercharged generalised compassion, but very often a failure to see the sort of the personal wood for the trees.
Right. And yet she did in those two letters.
Exactly, and... when what was the name of the Neumann, the writer? I was very friendly with Dr. Paul Neumann, who was a lawyer. And there was another Neumann, well-known chap, who was an author, and his wife was friendly with Eleanor. Well, the author Neumann had fallen in love with somebody, and the wife was very, very upset, and she did discuss her problems with Eleanor, who'd heard my name linked with Paul Neumann and thought that I was the woman in the case, and she tackled me about it, which was already very embarrassing for her to do. And I said, but I've never met the man in my life. I think you've probably heard that I am very friendly with Paul Neumann. Do I know Paul Neumann? I said, yes, I introduced him to you quite recently. We walked down the road together. Oh, Feasty, I had a load off my mind. I am so, so glad. Well, you know, I could be as friendly as I like with Paul, but the idea that I should, that somebody close to her should break up the marriage of you know, a friend of hers.
How does this fit then with what she was saying earlier about her being motherly? I mean, is she really motherly? I mean,
no, not.
I mean, because you were saying that Mary Stock's biography doesn't bring that out enough.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't bring out the general warmth. But those letters have the general warmth, haven't they?
Yes, they have. Yes.
A certain shy warmth, I would say, wouldn't you?
Yes, quite.
But,
yes.
With the small children, with her own family, for instance, every time that one of her nephews or nieces or somebody produced a new child, you know, and every time really that she heard of somebody sort of falling in love and marrying and then in due course having children, she was really delighted about this. Mm. And I think with her own family,
warmer than she appeared to feel.
Oh, far warmer, certainly.
That's where I wish I had some family contact.
Yes.
But, for instance, you were stuck in that flat by yourself in weekdays anyway. Did she ever say, well, come round to my flat for a meal, or... are you getting enough to eat, or anything like that? Did she show any personal concern for
you? Well, yes, I went round to her a lot. But, no, I don't think she ever showed any sort of concern as to...
your welfare?
No, not really, no. Mm. I said to her once that... I must go away. I would like to go away for a holiday, that I had been living with the refugee problem for such a long time, and I said, I remember that I said, you know, I've had refugees for breakfast and lunch and all through the day and at night, and she said, well, I've always thought it was quite unnecessary at night. Which goes nicely with the promiscuity story.
And the point of that being that they shouldn't contact you at night, or what?
No, I think it was also that I shouldn't let my private life, you know, extend beyond sort of reasonable or even unreasonable office hours.
Oh, right, yes, yes.
And I mean, there was a certain nice sort of bit of humour about that. And and she said, well, you know, I don't see why it should get on top of you, because I have it all the time too, and I'm a lot older than you are, but perhaps I'm tougher. And I said, no, it's not the same thing at all. You have a lot of other important things other than refugee problems. Yeah. And I have the concentrated refugee problem, and I have the actual people coming and weeping in my office. And you know, I sometimes wake up in the night, and I mean, I find that I'm in tears, and I cried all my tears many years ago. I don't let things get me down to that extent now, and you know, I suppose at that time I wasn't sort of far off breakdown, and I went out for a week or something to Graham White's cottage on the foot of Snowdon and recovered. But I mean, I had really had absolutely concentrated refugee misery,
right,
day in and day out for...
Where she at least had Parliament, well,
yes,
and political life.
Yes, exactly, and she had other things, so if, family allowances or whatever cropped up, or world affairs, I mean, you know. And
was she awkward with individual human beings generally, would you say?
With?
Awkward with individual human beings. Was she sort of shy, uncomfortable?
In your bit, you had a lovely remark from Harold Nicholson, that people saw her coming down the corridor and bolted round. Well, this is marvellous, because that's absolutely what happened. And a lot of...
She terrified people, really.
She terrified this kind of minister and, you know, the civil servant.
Yeah.
The...
civilised, sort of.
Sort of well-brought-up Englishman.
Yes.
The sort of... Well, I'll say Carrington and,
right,
and Graham White and people like that. Oh, my God, you know. And because she had this marvellous sort of forceful intensity, and if she was going to pin somebody down, she damn well pinned them down. I found this lovely little bit. Now, there was a deputation to see Morrison.
And
Morrison was, you know, he just stonewalled the whole way through. At the end of the delegation, it was with Dr. Temple and the moderator of the Free Churches.
Right.
And Miss Rathbone then said that it fell to her lot to close the interview by thanking the Home Secretary, but she felt that she had nothing to thank him for, as he had not made a single concession of any sort, nor had our representations made the slightest effect on him. To thank him under these circumstances would be merely an empty formality, and she did not propose to do so. Now, you see...
What was the date of that?
That was
There's some good sea signs, unfortunately.
Sounds about 1943 or something like that, I don't know.
That must have been...
The deputation during the war about the refugee question, I imagine.
Yes, the material in the memorandum. 1941, a report on activities and a second memorandum from the Parliamentary Committee. And I feel that it would be a good thing if you could add a little more specific parliament. You said there was something about a disparate group of MPs.
Yes.
But she, for thousands, tens of thousands of refugees, the name of Eleanor Rathbone is synonymous with the Parliamentary Committee on Refugees. She formed the thing. She did all the bludgeoning, but she made a whole lot of MPs take an active part when, you know, they would have rather just sort of, well, not been stirred up.
Right, yes.
Yes. Mm. She did all the stirring up.
Mm. Yes, I'll certainly do that.
Would you like some this?
I'd love to have a look at those, if I may.
Yes,
yes. I mean, don't put them away.
No.
But did you ever see her and Eleanor, Eva Hubbard together?
Oh, yes.
And what were they like together? Can you sort of generalise about that?
Well, I was trying to think after I had made that remark, and I...
And were they very easy together?
No, I wouldn't say they were. I think it's possible that Eva irritated Eleanor a little bit.
I mean, because they've been colleagues for so long,
yes.
They've worked together.
Yes,
so
I think it is possible that that on Eleanor's side there was some degree of irritation.
Mm.
And...
because they're both very strong personalities.
Yes, yes. I met them in the first instance together because I took over from Aline McKinnon the secretaryship of the Refugee Public Opinion Council at a time when I was working in Bloomsbury House. And I think Eva probably, if you like, tried to do too much there and too much her way, you know. I think that's the kind of memory that I have,
right.
You know, Eleanor to sort of see this woman, you know, without saying
it. But Aline McKinnon, you said
Aline McKinnon.
Yes. She said, "How can you possibly
like
that?"
Oh, she disliked Eva terribly. I mean,
and the objection was that. What did she say exactly then?
I think she thought that she was sort of rather bombastic and opinionated. I think.
So certain she was right.
That's it. Mm. Aline was a very, very strong personality herself.
Right, yes. But, you see, another thing really that occurs to me is that this is the time you knew Eva was the time that Charles Grave died. Charles Grave, the journalist.
Yes.
Or at least the artist.
Yes.
Punch.
Yes.
And somebody told me, I can't remember who, that in fact they were in love.
Yes.
That is, she was living with Charles Grave, and that's why it in fact caused her such great distress. Well, that would be the time when you were going out with Eva in restaurants in Soho and things, and she probably felt very lonely and wanted to talk to somebody. I mean,
yes.
You had her at a very vulnerable period of her life. But did she tend to unburden herself to you then? Was that why you got on so well with her, really?
Yes, I would say that she unburdened herself in a generalised way.
Just talked about how awful things were, or not specific about her personal problems.
Not about her personal problems, but about her personality and about this business of finding that, you know, she was still, if you like, ready to fall in love at the age that she was, fell for the same sort of people that she would have done at an earlier date, and that she really hadn't learned anything over the years.
But the main point was that you remember was the shyness one.
Yes,
she thought
yes.
She'd get over her shyness and hadn't.
And hadn't. Mm. And she knew, of course, that she overcompensated for it.
Yes, yes. So she still felt nervous when entering.
But I don't know whether she was ever aware of the fact that she annoyed people as much as she did.
It was just that she was sort of...
She wouldn't find that with me because she never annoyed me, you know?
Yes, and anyway, you weren't a rival in a sense.
No, exactly,
I mean, you weren't
exactly.
Competing in a way.
The only thing that annoyed me was that she never pulled her stockings up. The man are coming down. No,
a
I mean, they were always wrinkled round her ankles and... she was sort of... sloppy about such things, and Eleanor was careless about her dress, but not to a sort of noticeable degree. I mean, she just couldn't be bothered to, whether the hat she wore, whether she'd worn it 100 times or 2,000 made no difference to her. MacAdam would have seen that the hat was respectable, you know, and that her clothes were clean and neat. Yes, it was the, it had been my old Fleet Street office, I think. There was a desk, two desks, and a typewriter. They were my property, I think. Probably the typewriter I expect came over from Marshall Street. I can't remember how much came from Marshall Street. We had a filing cabinet, of course, and an extra armchair, and that was about it.
And what was in the filing cabinet then? Would there be individual records?
Oh yes, we had over 10,000 at the end of our life. We had over 10,000 actual individual cases of refugees, either from internment or, you know, their personal case histories. And very many of those had been interviewed by me in either Marsham Street or in Cowley Street.
Mm. So you had files for each individual person?
Yes, yes.
Really?
It must
have been quite a big thing.
And when I went to the International Red Cross at the end of 1944, when Eleanor wrote those letters, I think Eric Hirsch and all the files went to Gollancz's office. I think he made an office available for them.
I see.
And when I was in Germany, I heard that the whole lot had been destroyed.
Yeah.
But there were so many lot of private details in them.
Mm.
I asked Helga to save certain things for me, and I still have those private files, which are
of enormous interest because they include the sinking of the Arundora Star and some of the people who were on it and such things.
Mm. Mm. But what went on in this office? Was there just you in it or were there other people?
No, Helga was there. In the early days of Marsham Street, there was a refugee, Eric Hirsch, as an assistant, William Pickles, you know William
Pickles? Oh yes, the political scientist, yes, really.
He died a year or two ago, didn't he?
Mm.
He was a dear chap, he was a volunteer. Prakash Datta, Professor Prakash Datta of, well, he was a boy then, he was only about, I suppose, about 20. Mm. And his mother had married the head of the Christian College of Lahore. And they were, his mother was very friendly with Eleanor. And I remember my amazement when I was told that Prakash had offered his services and Eleanor told him to come and see me. And I opened the door, and he was as tall as the chap who as David who left when you arrived, but much larger, and a very dark-skinned Indian. And I remember looking up at him as he filled the doorway and I'd been, oh God, what on earth am I going to do with this chap? But he was marvellous. He worked throughout his summer vacation, and we were so inundated with requests for help. At that time, very largely, from people who were still hoping to get news of their relatives on the other side before. Then, of course, the internment rush came, and that was the main preoccupation.
You're talking about 1940. Yes.
1939, I was still in Bloomsbury House, and then in the end of that period, I joined Family Endowment. That's how I got into 35 Marsham Street.
Mm.
When about in May, the overrunning of the Low Countries, then the internment scare started.
Mm.
And that's when the Parliamentary Committee really became most active. It had been,
right.
I think, started a couple of years before.
That's right.
You know, only as
to get the refugees out.
Yes, that's it. And as a
but what did you have at Marsham Street then? Did you have bigger quarters at Marsham
yes,
Street?
Yes, because it was the offices of the Family Endowment Society.
I see. So what was there then, roughly, Mrs. Shirley?
There were two big offices, about the size of this room at least, and with desks and filing cabinets and the like, but the filing cabinets would have all been, it would all be Family Endowment property.
Mm-hmm.
And Marjorie Green had handed over to Vida Barclay.
Mm-hmm.
And Vida Barclay was, I think, communist, or at any rate, very, 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 very left-wing, and therefore running her sort of own private affairs as, I should think, probably Family Endowment was a bit of a cover for whatever she was really doing. And I expect Eleanor was speaking about Vida one day when she asked me if she had been told that I was a communist. And that I shouldn't be working for her. And she faced me with this, and I said, no, I've been associated with communists. I was going to write the biography of Tom Mann, and I knew him well. And I said, you know, that this was probably why she had heard this story, but it was that I'd never been a member of the Communist Party. I couldn't possibly be, you know, I was liberal, if you like. And,
yes. Would it have worried her, do you think, if you had been a communist?
Yes, she said, I realised that if you were, you wouldn't tell me the truth because they're such liars. I have had the experience when I've asked people this question and they have denied it just as strenuously as you have. And then I've gone to have afternoon tea with them and seen Uncle Joe on the mantelpiece.
Mm. Yeah.
So I said, all right, you won't find Uncle Joe on my mantelpiece and you can come in any time you like. And then I told them the Tom Mann story, of course, and you know, that's how I got sort of mixed up with communists in general.
Yes, well. Because Donna Torr eventually wrote the first volume of the Bible. Mm-hmm. Donna Torr first volume of it.
Well, Donna Torr was in fact put in by the Communist Party when I refused to write the book with a committee, which was what they proposed. So they got Donna Torr to write the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also refused, asked her to hand over my material, but I mean, then I packed it up.
If one gets back to the Marshall Street setup, then it's quite a big one with two big rooms, desks and files and books and all that, and several people in it. I mean, whereas the place where you had your flat was a one room thing.
Yes, that's right.
With really only room for two people.
Well, yes, certainly room for two people, myself and the secretary, and that was absolutely, you know, all there was room for.
Mm.
But in the big rush of 1940, do you know Edith Finer? Maurie Finer's widow?
No, I've heard the name.
Well, Edith Rubner, she was then. Mm. She was a tremendously bright sort of 18, 19-year-old. She came along and helped us do. And they were all volunteers. And they did, you know, they filed papers and did things like this. And wrote on letters, passed them up to me, you know, suggest take this and this action, or shall we write this and this kind of letter, and so on.
Yes. But what actually went on in this little room later then?
In that little room later, all the sort of correspondence on actual, I did all the actual casework. Mostly without any consultation with Eleanor, because I would sort of make the inquiries about people who were interned as to whether they should or shouldn't be interned. And I knew from, you know, my Bloomsbury House days, which were the sort of the wheels to turn to find out on what sort of grounds people have been in, and then to approach the home office when the case history was complete, you see. So there were a lot of sort of preliminary inquiries to be made on every case, and there were hundreds and hundreds of cases that had to be dealt with.
So how did you divide your responsibilities between you and your secretary? The secretary was literally a typist.
Oh, she was a typist.
Mm.
And that's Helga. And,
of course, yes.
Helga was then sent off by Eleanor to achieve her heart's desire and become a teacher. And she went up to the Ambleside training thing at Eleanor's expense.
Mm. So there's another example.
Exactly.
How she looked after
people. And, I had a card from Helga on a holiday in France or Austria or somewhere the other day, and she said that Dr. Harrison I was so pleased that Dr. Harrison sent me what he had written. Mm. Of course, I was too young in those days to know very much about Eleanor, but the memory of an outstanding personality will remain with me or something like that.
Yes.
But she had her... Eleanor was, in fact, she was extremely touched by Helga's situation. Helga, having lost both her, both parents were probably perished in one of the death camps. Her brother had emigrated to South America, her only brother, and Helga had come here as a little, then little fat thing of about 14. And she was a tough little creature, and she couldn't type, and she was, and I had seen a number of qualified people, and I was unable to take on the qualified people and decided that it had to be Helga. And she did, in fact, learn eventually to type quite decently, and by the time she was really useful to me, Eleanor had also felt equally touched by her and sent her on to Ambleside. So I was deprived of my secretarial help.
Supposing I'm a refugee and start crying on your shoulder then, in that room.
Yes.
Helga's there.
Then I take you into my private room.
Yes, I see.
And if people were in, let's say, in sort of dire personal distress, then I would probably say to Helga, I'll see them in my own room.
Mm.
So my own room was always... It was bed sitting room, and the bed became a perfectly respectful sort of couch during the day. I also had a desk in there. God, I wish I had it now. It was a beautiful Dutch inlaid. I think I saw it in Philip Bonham's catalogue, and it went to America for about 45,000 quid.
Really?
That was my desk, yes. I could have done with that now. Yes, please.
I was just going, how do you cope then with Eleanor, liaising with Eleanor? You had a telephone, so you just rang her up quite a lot.
But more often I would go over quite early in the morning with a sheaf of papers and say, could I just ask you about so-and-so? And then I would show her, leave with her at the end of the day, the letters, not all letters, but most of the letters that I had written.
Mm-hmm.
And then she would tell me sometimes, VC, I was rather distressed about the letter that you wrote to the Home Office. I don't think you should have written that on our behalf. That only happened, I think, on one occasion, and that was the occasion when there was a German Jewish policeman interned in the Isle of Man, and he was there long after everybody else had been out, and I'd written to the Home Office, and I said, we're still very much concerned. He was a traffic body in Berlin. There is absolutely, as far as we are able to discover, there is absolutely nothing against this man except that he was a traffic policeman in the pre-Hitler days in Berlin. And unless the Home Office takes the view, once a policeman, always a crook, we cannot see why it should remain locked.
Naughty, but quite understandable.
And I ought not have done this on parliamentary committee. But that was, I think, about the only occasion that she demurred.
What about Elizabeth, actually, Elizabeth McCann? Did you have anything to do with her much?
I had quite a lot to do with her, of course, and she was very, very protective of Eleanor. And Elizabeth and I, she obviously liked me, and we got on very well together, but nevertheless she felt that I was
I mustn't take up too much of Eleanor's time, and then I mustn't burden her with this, that and the other thing, because she had too many other things to do. And I would say that she guarded, or tried, she didn't succeed, but she tried to guard Eleanor very jealously. And as you know, there was this lovely situation between Mrs. Wilson, the housekeeper, and Elizabeth. And Mrs. Wilson, I think, usually came off best.
Mrs. Wilson was a sort of cockney cleaning lady.
Mrs. Wilson.
Yes.
Yes, she was the cockney housekeeper. And very tough. And she thought the world of Eleanor and less than the world of Elizabeth McCallum.
So how did she win then, when there were contests between them, do you think?
Well, she did whatever, you know, whatever it was that she had in mind to do. If Elizabeth said, some domestic affair, you know, what we'd have for lunch or something, if Mrs. Wilson had made up her mind that it was going to be that and that for the Duchess of Athol or whoever. In this kind of way, it was Mrs. Wilson who won the day.
On domestic matters.
Yes. At any rate, she thought she had won the day. I mean, you know, she would sort of be a bit triumphant. I told her. she's not getting away with that, not with me.
But it seems to me you had trying to look at it from your point of view, it seems to me you had a rather raw deal, really, because you were paying rent for a room which in fact was being used partly for...
I had a very raw deal in a way.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of sort of close friends of mine who knew the situation and knew really how impoverished I was in those days. I had a bicycle and I used to cycle out to Chingford rather than sort of pay a Green Line fare. And I certainly ate very badly. And they thought it was appalling. I mean, they thought I was being appallingly exploited. Well, I have never felt that I was being exploited because I was as much involved with the work as Eleanor was herself. And, sort of looking back on it now, I would still do exactly the same thing all over again. And in a way, I felt then, and still feel now, that I was enormously privileged to be given that amount of scope, that amount of trust from Eleanor. There are things that money isn't all that important in that sort of situation.
Not quite. Yes.
And so I really had a position where I was able to wield quite a lot of, not exactly power, but certainly I had the possibility of being enormously useful in a way in which I wanted to be useful to these people,
right,
about whom I felt very, very deeply, you see. And it was Eleanor who gave me that possibility. So, I would have been a sort of very mercenary sort of skunk if my reply, why doesn't she cough up another £100 or whatever it was.
You did feel, you felt your half-Jewishness coming out in all this. I mean, you felt you were defending people.
Really so much at the time. I felt, let's say, far more sort of drawn to Jews than I had felt in my youth. And I met so many delightful, charming wonderful people, etc., etc., that, you know, instead of being slightly ashamed of being Jewish and therefore arrogantly proud of being Jewish, I felt, you know, quite glad that I was Jewish. But I don't really think that it was the Jewish instinct in me, it was the humanitarian instinct in
right.
me.
Right, rather like Eleanor herself.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly,
yes.
Yes.
Yes. You said earlier on, I just want to make sure I got it right, you said you thought Eleanor in some sense matured, what, emotionally?
Emotionally.
What do you mean
yes.
by that exactly?
She had been very, very, I'm sure, without knowing her, but knowing her past, if you like, and in, from conversations that she had with me, I'm sure that she had been a very inhibited person emotionally. And at the sort of ripe old age of 60-something, with the number of Jewish friends that she made, she felt a kinship with them and a lack of inhibition that she had not known before. I think that would be true.
Mm. Yes, I'm sure that's interesting. So in a sense it forces personal contact, personal relationships
yes.
on her.
Yes. Yes, which she had avoided.
Yeah.
It was natural to her, really, not to get personally involved. I should think her involvement with Elizabeth McAdam was probably the closest personal involvement that she'd ever allowed herself to have.
Right.
And certainly her involvement with me was on a personal level, on a far more personal level than, for instance, it was with Doris or her secretaries, because she regarded me in a different light from her paid secretaries, who were probably, I mean, I don't know, but I expect they were much better paid than I was, or else they probably wouldn't have done the job, you know. And so we met on far more equal terms, would sound
more informal terms, anyway.
Yes, certainly.
Yes,
and more personal terms
yes,
than employer to boss. It was never that sort of relationship with us at all.
Right, yes. Well, it sounds from the way she talked to you, it sounds as though that was so. Except that she feels obliged to give you instruction about your personal life, which is a bit much, really. But the fact that she felt such embarrassment
about
it.
No, I would say that was very much on the basis of friendship rather
yes,
than...
Quite.
Yes,
mm,
yes.
Mm, mm. Now, that does shed a lot of light on some aspects of the whole thing, which I hadn't quite... Is there anything else you'd like to emphasise, which you want me to get into that piece, that you know, and to put it, get the balance right or the emphasis right? I'll sort out her
yes.
eyes, or at least
yes.
I'll be vaguer about her eyes.
I'd like to see these parliamentary committee papers. I think if you'd like to take those, would you?
That's really very kind of you. I could borrow them. I'd be very
yes.
grateful. Yes, that's very kind of you. And I'll let you have them back. I'm going for a week's holiday.
Harold Nicholson remark, you know, about people fleeing behind pillars when they saw her coming, that she had something awesome about her. In the Victorian rigidity, moral rigidity, for instance, she would speak of sin and evil, for instance, you know, referring to homosexuality or something, which nowadays people would take for granted, and certainly, you know, is there evil? I remember she astonished a German camp leader, and he honestly didn't know what she was talking about, but she meant, you know, is there homosexuality in the camp?
and because rumours of it had reached her, well, I remember too, she was speaking about, I have an idea it was Ernie Bevin, but I wouldn't like to be sure about that. She said to me, he lied to me, I would never trust him. But, you know, the way in which she said he lied to me, well, I mean, politicians, what do you expect? They all lie, don't they? And one would take lying as a sort of, you know, everyday...
Or evasion, anyway, as a, yes.
As a sort of everyday hazard of dealing with such people. Mm. But for her, it was absolutely crucial. And he was damned in her eyes.
And that combined with a rather formidable presence.
That's it, yes,
well.
Yes. Mm. And this way, a rather booming voice, a quiet voice, but nevertheless it was a resonant voice and it had tremendous authority.
Mm. Yes, I must get that in somehow.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't approve of promiscuity. And you know,
Whereas Eva wasn't like that at all.
Not at all.
I mean, not much presence, really.
Hmm?
Not much presence.
No. I would say not. There was something fussy about Eva. She was not altogether. Eleanor was very, very much, a powerful presence in her own right. And there weren't sort of loose bits of Eleanor, apart from her handwriting and this business of losing bags and necklaces and everything else wherever she went.
Mm.
Those were only the loose bits of Eleanor. The personality was absolutely there.
Like a rock.
Yes.
Eve was a little bit
smudgy.
Yes.
At the edges, and I suppose basically that there was this unsureness of herself.
Yes.
Of which she was all the time aware.
Mm. And yet such a competent woman, so able in so many ways. I'll send you my piece on it if I may. I won't expect you to comment on it unless you want to.
No, I
don't want to worry you about it, but I'd be very interested if you had the time just to read it, to let me know, because I don't know whether I've got her right or not. She's very, very different from Eva, from Eleanor. Very different type of person altogether, and yet equally admirable in a way.
Yes, but vastly different in style and personality and presentation and everything.
But when you went off to these restaurants in Soho, what were you doing exactly? Was it after hours sort of thing? With Eva, I mean, did she say, "Now come off and have an evening off," sort of thing?
Oh no, it was mostly lunch, I think, but. Mm. I think it was really look, I would love to have a talk with you about this and that. Could you possibly meet me? And we could meet in Soho and have a quick lunch.
You see, I ask you this because one of the things about Eva is that she was awfully good with young people. I mean, she was just very good at relating to younger people. A lot of people said that to me.
Yes.
And presumably you were very much a young person by her standards then, weren't you?
I would have been about 30, wouldn't I?
Would you? Yes. Yes, I was imagining you were even younger than that. But,
no. I'd been married a good many years then already. I think I was a sort of fairly mature 30. I wasn't really conscious
of being taken up as a young person. I see, really, yes, it's interesting. Well, anyway, if I may, I'll send it to you, but...
Please,
don't
please,
I would
like
worry
to do.
You, you know.
No, it won't worry me. And would you like to borrow these?
Well, it's awful.